This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. When you look at a map of the world's most violent cities, you will see almost all of them are in Latin America. We've been hearing about the causes and consequences of Latin America's crime on Morning Edition. Steve Inskeep has been in Venezuela, and to better understand the crime on the streets, he paid a visit to one of the region's notorious prisons.
Those prisons are legendary in many countries. It's said the guards control only the gates, leaving convicts to fend for themselves, even running criminal networks from inside. In Venezuela, efforts to inspect prisons have led to battles between guards and well-armed inmates, leaving dozens dead. I wanted to understand how a prison like that worked, and I was in luck. A colleague knew a man serving time in a Venezuelan prison. The prisoner got in touch with the leader of the inmates. He was said to be a one-time soldier convicted of murder. And that prison leader sent word that he would be willing to see us. Of course, we'd have to come to him. So on the appointed day, we drove up to the prison in the far western city of Barinas. The street that we're on, you can see many colors on the buildings, brightly painted buildings. You see blues and greens and oranges over this way. But the side with the prison is solid gray. You've got a wall of concrete, maybe 10 feet high, topped by a chain link fence, topped in turn by barbed wire. The steel gate looked secure, manned by National Guard troops with rifles. There's a sign here that says a list of objects prohibited inside this establishment, for example, firearms. Yet I knew that visitors inside Venezuelan prisons routinely see guns and drugs. At this prison gate, a guard was initially reluctant to let in a foreigner. But after we said just which inmate we were asking for, he let us pass. Nobody accompanied us as we turned a corner into a tangle of long, low buildings. So we've just walked past a little shrine to several saints, Catholic saints, and figures in the Santeria religion. Near that shrine, the inmate leader was waiting for us. His name was Wilmer Lopez. He didn't look so threatening, a man with average build, a checked shirt, and close-cropped hair. He took us on a tour around the prison buildings in which the inmates have slowly built their own world. Hundreds of men, most of them shirtless, stand or sit around the edges of a court, a sort of combined basketball court and soccer field. A few young men are kicking around a greenish ball in the middle of it. This patio is surrounded by concrete housing, concrete rooms. Guards come in here twice a day to count the inmates. Most of the rest of the time, the prisoners deal with a different authority, Wilmer Lopez. How many people live in this patio? 1,450, he says, in a prison built for about 400. Such overcrowding is normal in Venezuela. Lopez says he governs these men with the aid of a handful of others. Some of his aides followed Lopez around, men with bulges under their shirts. Once we spotted an inmate high on a wall, standing guard with what appeared to be a long gun. The inmates have their own security perimeter. On the day we visited, the guards at the front gate had no metal detector. The inmate security checkpoint did have a metal detector, which went off when Lopez stepped through. What do you use it for? Lopez explains through our interpreter that he used to have a rival for leadership who was getting weapons from the outside.
Once a National Guard was helping to pass a box of grenades.
Grenades, a box of grenades.
A box of grenades.
Now Lopez relies on this airport-style detector, which he had no trouble getting delivered. Maybe that's a sign of a high-crime country when even convicts need so much security. Last year, a rival group of inmates took over one of the buildings here, but eventually the National Guard moved in and removed them after a three-day battle. ¿Qué relaciones tiene usted ahora con la Guardia?
Bueno, gracias a Dios, no es por nada.
When we asked what relations are like between guards and inmates these days, Wilmer Lopez spoke of mutual respect. He said the guards live in the same reality we do. They want to go home to their families and be alive tomorrow. How did you become the leader as opposed to someone
else?
I often ask myself that question, he said. According to court records, Señor Lopez went to prison in 2002. He was in his early 30s then, a former army sergeant who turned to crime. He was one of four men who stole a car and murdered the driver with a 9mm pistol. Police killed two of the robbers and caught Wilmer Lopez, who was sentenced to 20 years. But Lopez says that by about 2008, he had fought himself into a position of leadership in the prison. He says he was a violent inmate in his early years, but insists he wants to rule through reason now. He applies what he calls our internal law. Men must take responsibility for their actions in this crowded prison where many sleep shoulder to shoulder in long hallways. I see one mattress after another mattress after another. Una cama, dos camas, tres camas. Mucha gente vive
aquí.
The government could do more to help us, Señor Lopez says. And yet many prisoners help themselves. There's construction going on, inmates building rooms on the roofs of old buildings and building cabinets using nail guns. Some of the wealthier inmates have private rooms with air conditioners and gray satellite dishes propped overhead.
DirecTV.
At a store selling fresh fruit, Wilmer Lopez takes a slice of watermelon and breaks the shell to get the last of it. Nearby, our interpreter notes, is a two-story tiki hut with a sound system.
This is when the family arrives, they can come here all together and they can spend time here playing.
The tiki hut is next to the pool hall, which is next to the cockfighting ring. It's not clear how the prisoners pay for these things. Authorities have described other Venezuelan prisons as centers of drug trading or extortion schemes conducted by phone. A prison leader is commonly called the pran, or crime boss. Lopez insists he is a different kind of leader. He uses a gentler title, which is visible on a sign on the door of the computer room. Leader Positivo, positive leader. He says he supports infrastructure improvements, such as the one we found as we walked along a rooftop.
It's kind of a rooftop gymnasium. It's got weights in here, weight machines, and a class of about a dozen men are doing exercises steadily, calisthenics.
And if this situation seems insane, Wilmer Lopez says it just reflects the world outside the gates.
What do you mean?
La medición real, o el barómetro que llaman ellos.
The barometer of a society is how they treat prisoners, he said. Justice applies only to those who have no money.
Y uno ve los diferentes estratos sociales.
There are different layers of society, he says. And prison experts say he's right. The pran, or leader, is at the top. Below him are prisoners who serve as clergy and the leader's lieutenants. Below them are police informants. At the bottom are prisoners with no friends or money, like the shirtless men in the courtyard waiting for the afternoon count. About 4 o'clock, a squad of guardsmen arrives. They instruct the men to move, one by one, from one side of the courtyard to the other. The prison leader, Wilmer Lopez, says in some ways his society is more orderly than what's outside. The country outside the walls is politically divided right now, convulsed by a disputed election. His prison is quiet, at least today.
That's Morning Edition Steve Inskeep, who's been in Venezuela. You can see video and a photo of the Barinas prison at our website, npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. Latin America has become the most violent region in the world. The capital of Venezuela, Caracas, had 3,800 killings last year and now ranks as the planet's third most violent city. The only places ahead of it are also in Latin America, cities in Honduras and Mexico. In fact, when a Mexican think tank listed the world's 50 most violent cities, 41 were in this region.
Morning Edition Steve Inskeep has a story now of a man who got in his car and left work one day. It took him 11 months to get home. The man is a banker in Caracas, where Steve recently met him.
The many varieties of Latin American crime include one type of crime the Venezuelan banker knows personally. Germán García Velatini told us his story at an outdoor table at a hotel with a view of a mountainside that climbs into the clouds.
I was kidnapped in February 2009.
Kidnapped, he says, a crime that's getting more common in Venezuela every year. García Velatini's departure from work in 2009 took him, as usual, to a highway ramp where he had to hit the brakes.
It was like a stopover by what I thought were policemen because their jackets.
It's like a checkpoint on the road. It looked
like a checkpoint. And they had long guns.
Like automatic rifles?
Automatic rifles.
Garcia Valentini is a trim man with glasses and a mild expression, which matches his mild tone as he describes learning the men were not police.
They took me out of the car and pushed me into another vehicle and injected me. I passed away in seconds.
You were given an injection where?
In the leg.
In the thigh?
Yes. When I woke up, I was being pushed in a small room. They took all my clothes.
Leaving him with only a T-shirt and underwear. These professional kidnappers held Garcia Valentini for months as they demanded ransom from his family.
They were very proud of what they were doing. They took pride on their profession.
Which was plain from the kidnappers' elaborate techniques. They kept him in one windowless room. Music constantly played so he would hear nothing from outside. Cameras followed his every move. He never saw his kidnappers, who pushed food through a sort of doggy door and also pushed in notes for him to read.
The written piece of paper was a set of instructions, which I was not to yell and not to hit the doors, and a list of questions, like, how much are you worth? Which is a terrible question, because if you are kidnapped by political reasons, you have some principles that you can stand by. Money doesn't have principle. Money is just your merchandise. So it's
all you mean to them is an opportunity to get some gold, basically.
To get some money, yes.
There's a lot of money to be had in Latin America. This is, in many ways, a golden time for the region. Brazil is a rising economic power. Mexico and Venezuela are enormous oil producers. Poverty is receding. Some people are actually migrating to Latin America from troubled economies in Europe. Yet the region's dramatic rise has come along with dramatic violence. Studies argue that crime is so serious it measurably restrains economic growth. Analysts say a variety of factors drive high crime rates, from income inequality to official corruption. The Venezuelan government itself once estimated that 20% of this country's crimes are committed by police. We're on a mountainside on this evening, overlooking the lights of Caracas, a breathtaking view. We're standing at the entrance to a gated community. There's a security booth here and a sign saying security is the responsibility of all. Just a little reminder that some of the most beautiful spots in Latin America can also be among the most dangerous, which we learned when we heard a story of a woman inside this community who invited us into her kitchen to tell us. She asked us not to use her real name. Instead, we're calling her Chelena. We had a glass of wine at the stone countertop in her kitchen. That's where she likes to chat with friends and where she told her story. 4 years ago, gunmen grabbed her adult daughter. Then they called Chelena's home, demanding money. I thought that if I started crying, they could hurt my daughter, Chelena said. I had to be as tough as they were. Chelena refused to pay ransom, insisting she had no money. Fortunately, the kidnappers were in a rush and freed the daughter in exchange for the car in which she'd been kidnapped. During the hours of negotiating, Chelena overheard one striking thing. A kidnapper asked her to hold on, please, while he took a call on another phone from his own daughter.
Papa está trabajando. Tranquila que ya papa...
Papa's working, the kidnapper said. Don't worry. This was for him just business. Because of the tough negotiation, he had a somewhat disappointing work night. But the kidnapping industry has innovators constantly trying new ways to keep the money flowing. We got a rundown of some of their innovations from Luis Cedeño of a Caracas organization called Paz Activa.
Traditional kidnapping is when someone is taken, their family is called, and they're asked for ransom.
That's the kind we just heard about. A different style of kidnapping is believed to be an import from Mexico, express kidnapping.
They take you in your car and they go around to ATMs and extract money from your accounts. They go to stores, they buy expensive watches with your credit card, and then, you know, after maybe an 8-hour ordeal, they take your car, but they leave you.
So that's express kidnapping. The widespread fear of kidnapping has created a market for still more creative techniques.
One of them being the virtual kidnapping.
What's a virtual kidnapping?
A virtual kidnapping is when you don't get kidnapped, but your family thinks you're kidnapped.
Your phone service is cut off, and during those anxious hours when nobody can reach you, the virtual kidnappers pretend they've snatched you and demand a ransom from your family. Like many businesses, kidnapping also takes advantage of telemarketing.
It's done from prisons,
where inmates make calls to countless people on a list.
We know who you are. We're going to kidnap you. What do you mean? No, we know who you are. We know the name of your children.
Some percentage of people will pay. The most terrifying style of kidnapping remains what happened to Germán García Velotini, the banker we met, who spent months in that windowless room struggling to keep his sanity by keeping track of the passing days.
I just cut my fingernails and put it every day of the week. I put one, this is represent 1 week, and the other, and I kept track until...
With little shavings of your fingernails?
Yes.
Wow. He had nothing to read but a Bible. He became more deeply religious. Once his family finally negotiated his release, the banker wrote a short book called Dios en mi Secuestro, God in My Kidnapping. His religion gives him comfort, though not security. How is your life different, your daily life different now than it was before you were kidnapped?
Well, my daily life began about 1 week after kidnapping. One of the advisors told me, well, Germán, from now on, you're going to be kidnapped by bodyguards. So I now ride on an armored car with escort. It's a sense that you are not free.
He never loses that feeling until he leaves Venezuela.
The most incredible is the day I go to the airport and pass through immigration. Then I'm free, completely free. And then if I visit any city, I just walk. I don't need to go to museums, shops, anything. I just walk in the city. It's a wonderful sense to be able to walk free.
At least until it's time to return to Caracas. When we said goodbye in Caracas to Germán García Velotini, he walked swiftly to his car. He climbed in the back seat. A driver and a burly bodyguard took up the seats in front.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. The woman we will meet next paid a heavy price for living in the world's most violent region. That region is Latin America, where crime rates have soared even as economies rise. Of 50 cities with the highest murder rates, 41 are in Latin America. Some of the most violent areas are in Venezuela, where Eloisa Barrios lives. She met Morning Edition Steve Inskeep as we continue examining crime in these nations so closely tied to the U.S.
The story of Eloisa Barrios is especially revealing, revealing because so many of her relatives have been killed, and revealing because of who she believes pulled the trigger. Some weeks ago, Ms. Barrios climbed into our van for a drive to a cemetery. That burial ground is outside a village in the Venezuelan countryside. We went there to visit the Barrios family dead. She slid open a steel gate and led the way inside.
So we're walking into the cemetery, surrounded by concrete block walls. Grave markers to all sides, crosses.
She moved down a row of graves, calling out the names of brothers and nephews.
Aquí está Rigoberto. Aquí Luis. Aquí Narciso. Y aquí Benito.
She told us 9 relatives had been killed in shootings over the past 15 years. All 9 were men. All 9 were young.
Born on July 13th, 1988. Died December 15th, 2012. Flowers on the grave, and a heart drawn in the simple concrete over that grave.
Eloisa doesn't visit these graves much. She's moved away from this village called Guanayan. She doesn't feel safe here anymore. She doesn't rely on the police for protection because she believes it was the police who sent most or all of her relations to these graves.
What do you think about when you come here?
I just feel sadness, she says, that so many are buried here. Since we've been standing here, a police vehicle rolled slowly by. The officers taking a look at us as they cruised past, and maybe it says something about the state of life in Venezuela and in Latin America more broadly that the police presence was not reassuring at all. Across Latin America, some police are heroes, and others are widely believed to be criminals. Venezuela's own government once estimated that police commit about 20% of the crime here. A 2006 investigation found that police killed an extraordinary number of people described as resisting arrest. Why do you think the police have come after your family so many times?
Bueno, como siempre lo he dicho, en principio...
She says my brother Benito was detained for a bar fight in the 1990s. He went to prison for a while. After that, she says he was marked as a bad man. Police in the village harassed him, beat him, and finally arrested him. He died in custody. Police were charged for that killing, but never convicted.
Y después que lo mataron a él, empezaron también con los otros miembros de la familia.
She says other members of the family were targeted over the years. Her brother Narciso owned a liquor store police officers frequented until he was killed after a disagreement. Again, police were charged, and two actually convicted, but the killings continued. Nearly all the crimes are officially unsolved. Eloisa Barrios admits she cannot be sure all her relatives were killed by police, but she is convinced that most, if not all of them, were. And though it makes her nervous to visit her village, she took us on a tour of the crime scenes.
Esta es la licorería donde cayó, donde mataron a Narciso, ¿eh?
So on this side of the street is the liquor store where one was killed. On this side of the street, another was killed. Back down this way and around the corner, yet another was killed.
What you see is what we call here a culebra.
That's what we heard from Luis Cedeño, who analyzes crime for the Venezuelan group Paz Activa.
A culebra would be a Spanish word for snake. But a culebra is something that brings other consequences.
Suppose a man is killed. His family complains to the authorities. Tensions rise, and over time, more people are killed.
Sometimes a culebra might involve police officers, and that then becomes a little more complicated, because then you have police officers using their uniform to what now becomes a human rights violation, because it's done from the state, with state resources. And
it might just be a revenge killing,
right,
of a kind that sometimes happens, but done by someone with the power of the state behind.
Right. And that's where institutions have to come in and resolve them before they become also participants of that violation.
Aquí a la derecha.
We're turning down yet another dirt street, just going a couple blocks to the next site of the next murder.
Las veces que mataron a mi hermano.
The Barrios family did seek justice in the Venezuelan courts. Frustrated by the results, they turned to the Inter-American Court on Human Rights. It's part of the Organization of American States. That court ordered the Venezuelan government to protect the Barrios family. Some were moved to new homes in the state capital. Yet even in their new city, more relatives were killed. In its formal defense before the Human Rights Court, Venezuela said there is no evidence the state is deliberately persecuting the Barrios family with, quote, a view to exterminating them. Venezuela also questioned the impartiality of the court, from which Venezuela's government plans to withdraw later this year. So we're rolling between the fences. Go to the right again, she says to the driver. We're rolling between the fences of this neighborhood, past the animals and some of the lawns.
Derecho.
It seems like almost every corner she can point out someone from her family who's been killed. In Venezuela, the Barrios family is unusual only in that so many from a single family were killed. It is considered normal for police in this country to be accused of murder. Seeking to understand what was happening, we spoke with an advisor to Venezuela's interior minister. In a long talk over coffee in Caracas, this advisor said the government has worked for years to reform the police. Many are poorly trained and educated. When they're given tests of their knowledge, many cannot read the questions. Some are frustrated that criminals buy their way out of a corrupt justice system, so they just kill suspects. Other cops are corrupt themselves. The government has approved new laws, new training requirements, and new systems to hear civilian complaints. But so far, it's hard to see much difference on the streets. As for the Barrios family, the official said simply, quote, why aren't those policemen in jail? I agree. After we finished our tour of the Barrios family's village, we offered to drop off Eloisa Barrios in the distant city where she lives now. It was evening when we arrived, and she insisted we must stop over to have some cake. It was a birthday party for her sister. The party spilled out of the house and into the courtyard, even out into the street. People smiled and danced, though when everyone posed for a family photo, we noticed something. The overwhelming majority of the family are women, the consequence of 9 men killed so young. And a few weeks after we left, we heard more news. A 10th male member of the Barrios family was killed, stabbed to death. He was 17.